Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, sometimes it creeps quietly, unfolding in ways we notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, wherever people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief in business as a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors or limiting beliefs? I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. I'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. This is Moved. Today, I'm joined by Edward Hibbert, founder and CTO of Freegal, a leading platform in the UK for giving and getting things for free, and a voice in the UK's Tech for Good movement. Edward is fascinating to speak with, and I'm thrilled to have him as one of my 289 featured people. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, Edward, good to see you.
Thank you. Bit too soon to say, I'd say, from your point of view, but hopefully it will be.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be good. We had a good conversation the other day, so I've been looking forward to it. I was thinking, actually, you're the first guest that I have that is focused on tech for good.
Not enough of us around, clearly.
I think hopefully there are many, and I would hope that I speak with many more people that are focused on tech for good. But I wanted to start there, actually, just get your perspective on what is tech for good and what it means for you.
Always a bit weird to position yourself as an expert, but I guess for me, part of the issue is that maybe when I first started in tech, there was a kind of opposition between particularly environmental stuff and technology. So technology was evil and damaged the environment, and that's changed over time. So now we have a lot of stuff that's environmentally beneficial that is tech related, but so that was kind of one aspect. And then another aspect, I guess, was that you get a lot of stuff, particularly in the tech world, cool stuff that happens in the business sector, which is primarily focused on making money, right? That's the job of the business sector. But there's other kinds of value aside from money. And if you can use some of that same tech to realize those other kinds of social good values, then that's quite interesting, because the charity and social good sector often misses out in that kind of world. Either misses out because it doesn't have the resources, or sometimes because it doesn't have the vision.
Yeah. So what are the kind of areas that you see as the opportunity for tech for good to be applied?
Well, one might be, if you think about advertising, right? Advertising is on all the websites and everybody hates it, right? But you put up with it in order to have free services. And that's just part of the deal. And you feel slightly grubby about the way you're sacrificing your privacy, but it doesn't stop most of us carrying on with doing that. But the mindset there for people who work in the advertising world about a really, really ruthless focus on how you get people through to some kind of conclusion, that can be a really good mindset to have in mind when you're trying to get them through to a different conclusion, which is a social good kind of aim. So my main gig, really, the main thing I do, which is Freegal, which is a platform for giving away stuff you don't need anymore. And I don't want to suggest that I do this perfectly or even well, but the aim there is really, well, we're not a shop. We're not trying to sell you something, but we are still fundamentally trying to get you on a website to go through a set of stages to achieve a particular goal. And there's sometimes a division in people's heads between, right, I'm a ruthless moneymaker who understands exactly how to optimize those flows, or I'm doing a good thing and therefore I'm assuming that everybody will cut me lots of slack if my website's a bit rubbish, and that they will understand I'm doing a good thing and therefore push through the pain. And actually, that's not necessarily true. People do cut you some slack if you're doing a good thing, but still, people care about whether things are easy to use. Now, like I say, I'm not saying that I necessarily do that well, but I think the mindset of that, that you can ruthlessly optimize to produce social good, is that's something that I like. If you can find clever tech ways of increasing the amount of altruism in the world, that's a result.
Increasing the amount of altruism.
Yeah.
I definitely want to come back round to Freegal, because obviously that's one of the main things that you co-founded, I think, back in 2009, wasn't it?
So yeah, that's
I
right.
Definitely want to come back round to that. But that sense of, because we touched on it last time we spoke, but that sense of altruism and wanting to focus on that, where does that come from for you?
Maybe, I mean, this is where you have to say things that make you sound a bit up yourself, but in some ways I've been very lucky, right? I'm lucky in the country I've been born, at the time I've been born. I've been lucky to have had a stable upbringing. My parents cared a lot, possibly too much, about giving an education to their kids. So I was very lucky in that respect. You know, I've got some skills. But
yeah.
These are things which have been largely given to me as gifts. Have you... This is a tangent, but have you ever seen a talk called Does Money Make You Mean? There's a great experiment in that where he runs a rigged game of Monopoly. So one of the players at random gets given two dice. They get more money when they pass go. It's just completely rigged, right? Mm-hmm. But it's completely random as to which of the two players gets this thing. And so they play the game, and obviously the person who gets that unfair advantage wins, right? And then they ask them about the game. And the person who got the unfair advantage, they're not dumb. They say, well, you know, obviously, but nevertheless, I made some really great calls. I did this and did that and did that. And it's like, and during this video footage and during the game, the person who gets this unfair advantage, they sort of stomp around the board in a really aggressive kind of way. And the other person is sort of retreating. But the genius of the experiment is that they put a bowl of M&Ms on the table and they say, oh, those are just for the thing we're doing with kids later in the day. And the person who gets given the unfair advantage, they steal more M&Ms from children. I mean, actually, both sides steal M&Ms from children. It's like everybody sneaks a sneaky M&M or two. But the point is that people who are given advantages generally tend to think, well, yeah, I had some advantages, but I really made the most of them. I really did. We underappreciate the level of luck. Right? And that's something which, as I got a little bit older and saw the lack of luck that some people have, the bad luck that people have, I thought, well, again, this does make me sound up myself, but since I have been fortunate and given some gifts, I should try to work out what I can do that gives some other people a bit of good luck as well.
Yeah, I love that. Does money make you mean? I've not seen the video, but I will watch the video. It makes me think, because increasingly we've been playing Monopoly as a family recently. And it doesn't always bring out the best.
It really doesn't.
We're quite nice people in the family, but playing Monopoly, I feel like we're not necessarily the best versions of ourselves.
You know the thing about the history, though, of Monopoly, that it was originally designed to illustrate the evils of capitalism, like the really
I did not know that.
The real first, I think the first, I mean, this is one of the things you need to fact check, but my understanding is that the very first version of it was done with that intent, but somebody thought, oh, there's a brilliant game here and made loads of money out of it. So we kind of... didn't work out quite how they expected.
Yeah, fascinating. So one of the first things you did then was Freegal, is that right? Or were the things before Freegal?
Well, no, I mean, I had a proper job, which is a bit demeaning to the charity sector. But, so I worked in a kind of conventional IT software development firm for 18 years, something like that, selling email and voicemail type software to corporates in the US. So fairly straightforward business world. That makes me sound like I ran it. I didn't run it. I wrote some code and managed a few people in that. But that I did that for a while, and then gradually got more interested in this whole, well, what can tech do that makes the world a little bit better? And what can I do, I guess? So we talked before, there's a kind of weird overlap between stuff that needs doing, stuff that you can do, stuff that you like doing, and you know, where's the middle of that Venn diagram? So I got first involved in this whole online gifting area maybe back in 2005, something like that. Yeah, this this is a little anecdote about tech arrogance, right? Back in the day when I started on this, FreeCycle was the name in town, and this was all run on Yahoo Groups, and you know, you remember Yahoo, big in the 90s, and that was a free platform, and everything ran on that. And I discovered this, and I thought, oh, that's brilliant, that's so fantastic, because I had a carpet to get rid of, and I kind of Googled to find if there was a way of doing it, and I found this thing, and I thought, damn, I wish I'd thought of that. That was really, but nevertheless, I sublimated my annoyance at not having thought of that into kind of volunteering with it and giving stuff away on it. And then when I was volunteering, the shine slightly went off, because I thought, this is really, really socially worthwhile, but in practical terms, it's excruciatingly dull, because you have to click here and click here and go there and copy and paste this and do it. It's just awful as a, you know, as a techie looking at the interface. So I wrote, and I hunted around for a tool that you could use to make that easier, and I couldn't find one. And what you do in those circumstances is, if you fail to find one, you build a terrible version of what you're looking for, and you put it out there, and then all the people who never replied when you asked for one say, you're an idiot, why are you using that, you should be using this instead, right? And that flushes people out of the woodwork. Except it didn't happen. So then what happened was, people just started using my terrible tool instead, and then I had to make it better, and that sucked me into the whole world of building tech for this online reuse world. After a good few years of that, I decided it was kind of a bit more fun, really, than my day job. So I left that and went for a long walk to stretch my legs from Land's End to John O'Groats, and then moved into the charity sector and kind of gradually into the tech for good world. Because, like I say, I find it interesting that you can do good stuff there.
So is Freegal registered as a charity from the outset?
In a weird kind of way. So most people in the UK, when they think of a charity, think of a registered charity, which is registered with the Charity Commission, and that means the Charity Commission is the oversight. That isn't the only legal structure that a charity can have. So Freegal is a different kind of legal structure, a thing which used to be called Deep Breath Industrial and Provident Society for the Benefit of the Community, which is a kind of a co-op, and the co-op is a good example of this. So you can be charitable but have different legal structures, and we have that different legal structure. So you can still, you know, get free Google Ads and gift aid and that kind of stuff, but your regulator, slightly weirdly, is the Financial Conduct Authority rather than the Charity Commission. And that sounds like a very complicated decision to have made, but it's partly about who owns the organization, right? It was quite important when we set up Freegal that it couldn't just be owned by the board and they could decide what to do, and if the volunteers didn't like it, well, tough. Anybody who pays their quid and gets to be a member of the kind of organization gets a vote, and so that way is a kind of safeguard on the, in quotes, top of an organization going rogue away from the roots of it. And it was a grassroots movement, so that was quite culturally important to us. Long-winded explanation, and it causes some problems because you have to do some version of what I just said every time people say, are you a charity? And then you have to go, well, sort of, but... Yeah. And so the short answer is, yep, but... it takes a little while to get there. And you can't register with the Charity Commission unless you have a certain level of income. So you have to have some process before that.
Yeah.
My main advice, actually, for anybody thinking of starting a charity, is don't, because there are a lot already. and in some ways, don't start a new one. Find one that's already doing something in the rough area that you're wanting to do, and just go and help them instead. Because unless you really like admin and accounts, you'll end up spending more of your time doing that stuff than actually what the mission is sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And what is the mission?
For us, so for Freegal, it's to promote reuse, which is slightly separate from recycling. So that's still maybe not clear, perhaps, for some people. Recycling basically is smashing stuff up and then trying to do something useful with the fragments, right? So melt them down, convert them back into something. And reuse is taking an actual object that actually exists and trying to find it a new home, either doing the same thing or doing something slightly different. And that might involve refurbishment, might not. And so reuse is fundamentally better in environmental impact terms, but it's a lot harder to do, and a lot of the big infrastructure around waste in the UK is around recycling, and there's not enough reuse. So Freegal, and there are other people who do this kind of thing, but the idea is you've got something you don't need anymore. People often make the mistake of thinking that because they don't use it anymore, nobody would want it, right? And that's an easy thing to assume. But actually, the way to find out if anybody wants something is to see if anybody wants it, right? So before you put it in the bin or before you get the council to take it away, you post up a photo, a little description of what the item is, and then people can reply. They come around, they take it away. No money changes hands. And this is partly about what I was saying before, about the difference between value and money. If you want rid of something, you want the space, right? You might get some value from having the space. You might get some value from meeting somebody new, helping somebody nearby. There's different kinds of value that are not purely financial. And we are, sometimes say we're like online dating for stuff. I mean, online dating is perhaps not a slightly jaded idea now, but but the idea is that we don't physically touch the items. We just put people in touch. Somebody who has something that they don't need, connect them with somebody who needs something they don't have.
Yeah, more of a platform.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that partly comes from what I can do, right? I can build software. I can't drive a delivery truck. So I'm not going to be doing the traditional charity shop model.
Yeah. So tell me about the Freegal's 16 years or so old, isn't it now? So tell me a little bit about the development of it and where it's at the moment.
Yeah, so, 16 years old for an online platform that's run by a bunch of volunteers, that's not a bad outcome, right?
Good.
Yeah. Where's MySpace again? And there's lots of challenges associated with that, right? So when we started, as a lot of kind of social movements start, what happens is you just start on whatever the social platform is of the day. Right? And back when Freecycle got started, Yahoo Groups was a big thing, and it's hard to remember that now, but it was a place where people would go and they would do stuff. Just like Facebook became later, and then maybe kind of WhatsApp and Instagram, and it always moves on. So for a lot of movements, including us, what happens is you start, you get a critical mass, because it's a new idea, people leap on board, and you use a platform that exists because that's where everybody is. And then slightly further down the line, you realize that the platform you joined either isn't quite suited to what you're doing, or maybe has just fallen out of use amongst members of the public. And sometimes you'll try and build your own platform to replace that. That's quite a big challenge. There are good reasons for doing it, but it means you're then taking on the burden of running a platform yourself. And in techie terms, we built our own platform, and we then ran that in parallel with Yahoo Groups for many years, which was just like the worst migration of my career in terms of, you want a migration to be done quite rapidly. You don't want to run two things in parallel for years. But part of that was about building trust and not losing your user base. You have to give them a graceful path. And if you just suddenly say, ah, that thing you're doing, you have to do that over here now, most people will say, well, I'll do something else then. I mean, you lose your users if you do that. So we started with a bunch of volunteers, and at that stage, free platform, didn't need any money. So that's quite straightforward, can run that with volunteers. Then once you build your own platform, you get to the point where you think, well, actually, you know, it does, you can do some things with volunteers, and I love volunteers. I mean, I'm involved in the Volunteer Centre in Edinburgh, where I used to live, and I think volunteering is just a beautiful thing that is increasing the amount of kindness in the world. But there's some certain things where there's no way around it. It's really hard to find volunteers for hardcore coding skills, or often for financial stuff, or somebody who can go on a regular committed basis during working hours to somewhere. These are things that are hard to find volunteers for. So we do now have, not staff, we have some contractors. I'm one of those. I get paid to do the tech stuff. So we make enough money out of donations to keep going, but it's a real struggle, right? Because it's hard. It turns out giving stuff away for free is not the most lucrative business model. And it's that, in a sense, perfectly fine. Don't want it to be lucrative, not interested in that. But it needs to generate enough money to be sustainable. Even in an organization that's focused on sustainability, you still have to have a sustainable organization. And that's hard work.
Yeah, when you think about it, because I guess with those platforms where people are buying and selling used items, there's often a small markup that the platform will take. But if you're exchanging them for free, then you're providing that as a service. But yeah, you would be entirely reliant on donations, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain stuff you can do. So just to be clear, the main thing about Freegal is not whether it makes money. It's about whether it enables somebody who, you know, is got bare floorboards to get a carpet or that kind of thing. Or somebody clearing their parents' house after their parents have passed away. It can be much nicer to give those things to people who are starting out in life rather than see them loaded into a van and then come across and fly tip by the side of the road later. But nevertheless, you need a core amount of money to keep going. You can make some money from donations from people when they use the site, but it's kind of important for us that it is free to use. And so you could sort of imagine having a subscription model, but that doesn't really work. I mean, who's going to say, what, I have to sign up to pay something in order to give something away for free? Don't be daft. And so people wouldn't do that. But you can ask for donations from people, and you get some from that. You can get some money from advertising on the website, which doesn't raise anything like as much money as people think it does. It's a bit difficult for us sometimes because a lot of advertising is fundamentally buy more stuff, and we're maybe don't buy so much more stuff. So there's a kind of conflict there. There was a period in the charity world where there was a lot of voting based funding, where you could, people who were giving away money, which they don't have to do, would get publicity for that by saying, well, go and vote for the charity you want to receive the money. And we got quite good at winning those competitions because we have quite a lot of members, and they're even the ones who either aren't able or don't want to support us financially can still do a couple of clicks to win a vote. That fad for giving away money in voting competitions seems to have passed, though. Unfortunately, that no longer seems to happen. We get a little bit of money from councils because we are kind of doing councils' jobs in some ways in promoting reuse, which is something councils want to do. But the council world is a bloodbath at the moment, really, in terms of funding and predictability. So it's hard work for them to keep doing the stuff that they are legally obliged to do, let alone some of the kind of discretionary good stuff that they would like to do. So so we cobble together enough to keep going, and that maybe sounds a bit negative. It is an enormous achievement for us to still be around 16 years down the line, right, compared to so many good endeavours that have come and gone. But I don't want to suggest it's easy.
No, I can imagine.
Anybody out there?
What's the active user base?
Probably there's a slight difference between the number of people who are registered and the number of people who are active. Active monthly is probably a few hundred thousand. It's the kind of thing, it's a different thing from like your social media site. You go on there multiple times a day, right? Whereas with Freegal, you'll go on there when you have an item you want to get rid of or there's an item you'd like to get hold of. And so it's driven in some ways by external life events more than, oh, I'm just going to go on and do my thing. It's not quite the same as a normal social media site. So we're modest in, you know, we're not a tech titan, but it's not a not a trivial amount of activity either.
And for the techies and product people, can you tell us a bit more about the technology platform itself and maybe some of the challenges with it and what you would love it to do that it can't currently do?
Okay, so what, even with like technology buzzwords that will sound like I'm showing off or what?
Well, I'm quite interested, but yeah, right. Within reason.
Okay, so, right, starting at the very back end, there's a database, right? And the database is your crown jewels. And that is a cluster because it's like you have to be available. So even if you're a free site, if somebody goes on and sites down, well, they might come, they might never come back. So you have to care about availability. And that, and a lot of our other services hosted on a lovely service by a company called Crystal, who are a UK hosting provider who are into the environment and been very, very supportive to us. And they have a very nice platform called Catapult that is aimed at more the kind of thing that we do, where it's not just a simple WordPress site, but it's an actual more sizable service. We have a bunch of APIs, some of them using really, really antiquated PHP code, some of which dates back 15 years or so from when I first started writing that and is in desperate need of modernization, some of it a bit more recent. There's interesting technical challenges around the length of time it takes to write code versus the how fast it is to run once you've written it. So it's there's a kind of convention sometimes in performance analysis for software products that it's not worth doing. You just throw more money at the problem and wait for the computers to get faster and speed up, and then that will be cheaper than paying your developers to spend time agonizing over how fast their code runs, right? And that's fine if you have a revenue stream. But for us, since money's at such a premium, it does turn out to be cost effective to really try and optimize the speed of some things to reduce the hosting costs. However, and we have a web app and we have a mobile app. Again, just in technology terms, there's a move away from the model where you have your own servers. I mean, they're not real physical servers, but they're virtual servers that you administer and you configure and all that, towards more cloud-based services where you just write the code and somebody else takes care of all that infrastructure. And great, because your USP is not in being able to do server admin really well, right? That's not that's not what people care about. But those services can sometimes be expensive. So in some cases it makes sense for us to use it, in some cases it doesn't. Anybody who understood any of that stuff I just said and wants to help, do get involved. But in terms of what we'd like it to do, there are challenges here. So the key thing is that our competitor is the bin, right? So the easiest thing for somebody to do with something they don't want anymore is throw it away. Society is set up to make that easy, right? You've got, you've literally, well, actually not if you live in a flat and you just tilt on space, but many of us have a weedy bin sitting outside that you can chuck something into. And then if you don't want to do that, you can drive maybe to a tip that's not that far away and get chuck it in a skip there or put it in a container. Right, we've got all sorts of infrastructure around making it really easy to throw things away. Right, so that's what we're competing against, really, that fact that that's the easiest option. And so every time you have to type or click or wait or whatever, that is just another reason to use the bin. And that's the thing that keeps me awake at night, right? That unless you can make it as easy as that, then it's really hard. So for example, everybody in the tech world is obsessing about AI at the moment, but with good cause, because it is remarkable. And Freegle, traditionally, you might or might not add a photo and then you might write a description. Well, AI is getting really good at identifying what objects are now. So, and your phone knows where you are physically. So actually, it's not obvious you need any more than just a photo to basically say, well, here is this thing in this place. You have to care about what happens for visually impaired people. You know, visually impaired people need stuff too and are trying to give stuff away too. So you can't just do photos, but there is stuff there. Then there are some other slightly more subtle challenges around how do you show an item to enough people to get enough replies that it's likely to be taken, but not show it to so many people that most of them either are just fed up of seeing it or lots and lots of people waste their time writing a reply for an item that only one of them is going to get, and you have to spend your time dealing with lots of replies from people that are going to be disappointed. So actually there's some interesting stuff around there that we're trying to do some work on. Some of that is conceptually quite tricky, but and takes us into a whole world of geospatial stuff to do with. Let me illustrate that slightly. So a lot of geeks, when they're looking at geography, traditionally just used to do like a point and a radius, so something is in a particular place. But if you live in Bristol and you do a point and a radius approach, you quite rapidly start to include parts of South Wales. But those parts of South Wales are not convenient to get to because you've got the Bristol Channel in the way. So you need more sophisticated ways of dealing with the geography of places and the transport links in terms of working out who might be interested in seeing an item about whether it's
radius.
And also you get things like, there'll be some areas that are more affluent and some areas that are less affluent, and do you want to prioritize? There's a risk. Like, quite a lot of places have street-based WhatsApp groups, right? And they do reuse on there. People say, oh, I've got this. Does anybody want it? But that's quite cliquey in a way, because it's like, basically, you're giving it to somebody who can afford to live on the same street as you. But there might be somebody who lives half a mile away who could really use that a bit more. And if we're honest, needs it more than somebody who's living on your nice street. Don't get me wrong, nice streets are nice. I'm not complaining about that. But so there's all sorts of subtleties there around, it feels like giving something away, straightforward, how hard can it be? But actually, you've got to think about how to do that in a fair way and what's going on in people's heads. One of the things we learned quite early was that a lot of environmental causes, fundamentally, they operate by saying, here's a problem. I think this is the solution. Now I'm going to persuade everybody that I'm right. Firstly, right that this is a problem, and secondly, that this is a solution. And that's really hard work, right? Persuading people to change their views. We thought that with Freegle, people might benefit from it for completely different and conflicting motives. So you might want to give something away because you're just trying to do a good thing or you care about the planet. You might give it away because you're moving and you desperately need out of there. You might be too lazy to go to the tip. You might not want to pay the council to uplift it. You might want to meet somebody who's nearby. There are lots of different motives. And if you just focus on, right, what we're about is saving the planet, right? So don't get me wrong, saving the planet would be a good idea, but you've already pigeonholed yourself as a niche thing there, where you're only appealing to people who already think that saving the planet is a good thing. So actually, you want to pitch it more as a, it's just what you do, isn't it? Just as a kind of normal thing to do, and not focus too much on people's precise motivations in a way that would exclude people with other different, potentially conflicting motivations. You can tell, I find it fascinating, right? I think It is quite a simple thing. But nevertheless, like I say, the bin is still the competitor. We're still set up that the default is now that you smash something up and burn it, or melt it down and try and make something out of the remnants of it. That is our default approach to things that people don't want anymore. And there's a sort of lack of respect there for the objects and the history that they have and the effort and energy that's gone into making them that I think literally is a waste.
There's quite a throwaway culture, but actually material and things, it takes a lot of energy, water, effort to make them, and then all that's gone in, more than often you might realise for a given thing, and it's not necessarily end of life, but we have, it's quite easy to throw away the competitor, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course, why would you know as a member of the public how much energy it takes to make something, right? We can't expect people to, like, people talk about CO2, right? And people now understand that CO2 is a bad thing. But if you measure your impact in terms of CO2, you say, oh, it takes a ton of CO2 to make such and such. I don't know, is that a lot? If it takes 100 grams of CO2, is that a lot? If it takes 10 tons of CO2, we don't intuitively feel anything there. We don't, you know, that's why people start to try and translate it into number of trees planted or something. But it's tricky to understand the impact of the item. But yeah, from our point of view, try and give it away. If nobody wants it, well, you do what you're going to do anyway. You've not necessarily lost that much, except a little bit of effort to try and do the right thing. So try and give it away first.
Yeah.
Or try and get one for free first, if you can avoid that, avoid buying one.
Yeah. So this is an aspect of what we might call the circular economy.
Yeah, it is. Though some of the circular economy is based around, if you like, the whole life cycle of a product, right from manufacture through to eventual disposal. And the aim is to perhaps change how we produce things so that actually they can go around that loop a few times. Right? Mm. So I don't know, I'm making up an example that somebody who knows about sofas might say, no, that's not how it works. But if you imagine you have a sofa, a lot of the reason people will get rid of a sofa is not because the sofa frame is broken, the sofa is fundamentally broken. They've just gone off the fabric, right? Or the fabric's got worn. But we don't make sofas so that it's very easy to just change the fabric. Partly, there's the financial incentive. If it was really, really easy to get new covers on your sofa, then fewer people would buy new sofas, and the sofa manufacturers wouldn't necessarily be terribly happy about that. But there's a circular thing there where you can imagine that actually you could take a sofa that somebody doesn't want and recover it, and it becomes a sofa that somebody does want. And that's that's the more of the circular stuff. Sometimes what Freegle is doing is just delaying the point at which it then does get recycled or whatever, but even that delay can have a value. There's a I did this with an old, I used to live in Edinburgh, and I had an old CRT TV, and even at that point I thought, oh, nobody's gonna want this, and then I thought, listen to yourself, Edward, you keep telling people that you shouldn't think nobody's gonna want it, so I'll offer it up and see if anybody does. And somebody replied saying, all right, we're putting on a fringe production, and we just need a TV to sit on the stage in the corner for 4 weeks in August. Not even work would be fine. It just needs to sit there because it's like that's part of the set dressing, and a big bulky CRTV fits with the thing we're doing. And I thought, this is great. I wouldn't have thought of that as a use for it. And it just delays it by 4 weeks, right? It gets 4 weeks of use out of it before it then gets recycled. I used to tell this story, and then quite a few years later, I used to think of this as a great example of an unexpected way of using something that wouldn't get used. And then later on, I saw a story from another Freegler who said that they were looking for a big bulky CRT TV because their father had dementia, and they bought a new TV for him, a flat screen TV, because they were all flat screen TVs now. And he didn't use it because it just didn't look like a TV to him. It just sat in the corner of the room. I mean, it wasn't TV shaped. I mean, why would you think that that was a TV and you wouldn't turn it on. And so they wanted to get a big bulky CRT TV that looked, because they'd already got rid of the one that they had. And in fact, they got one from somebody else who'd gone through exactly the same process, but had a garage to put the old one in. And they'd done that with their mum. They bought her a new TV. She couldn't get on with it at all. They got the old TV out of the garage. She was then perfectly happy. And then actually she passed away, and they'd put the big CRT TV back in the garage, and then somebody wanted to see a big CRT TV, and there they were. And it made me laugh, really, because I've been saying for years that, you know, you just can't predict what somebody's going to do. And even though I've got a story in just this one area about CRTVs, I was still wrong. It would never have occurred to me that somebody would need a TV because of caring for a parent with dementia.
Well, we can often assume you've really brought it alive, because on a surface level I could just look at things like FreeCycle and Freegle and, you know, think I don't really know them though, and you've really brought it alive in terms of the tech and like the, you know, the drivers there and the complexity. The community aspect, did you call one of the users then a Freegler as well?
There's a mildly interesting story around there, perhaps. If you're in the tech world, you get very obsessed about patents and trademarks sometimes. And one of the things about trademarks is that you have to defend a trademark, right? So you have to pursue somebody who's violating your trademark in order to retain the trademark. And we decided we weren't having that nonsense. It's just a big diversion of effort. One of the ways in which you can make something not trademarkable is by promoting the derived words, so like Freegler, Freegling, Freegold, right? If those words, if you use those words, you're kind of undermining your own trademark and making it not trademarkable. And we decided that what we wanted to do was, you know, it's like, it's better if that kind of thing enters the common vocabulary. That's a win, right? Mm. People talk about hoovering the carpet.
Yeah.
That's great for Hoover. So actually, from our point of view, the more derived words, the better.
Right.
Yeah.
Very good. I wanted to come back to, you kind of touched on volunteering and how almost, you know, how special you see volunteering as, and an increase in the amount of kindness in the world. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So Freegle is powered by, run by volunteers, powered by cake, we sometimes say. And all of these people are doing a thing they don't need to do, right? Just out of kindness, they're giving energy and time and thought and care to helping people they may never meet. And I find that very moving. Volunteers aren't just a cheap way of avoiding peg salaries to people. They can bring a whole kind of special feel of their own. And one of the things I really liked about Freegle was that it offered volunteering opportunities to people who didn't necessarily have them. Freegle had a volunteer, a lovely woman called Wanda, who she was agoraphobic. She could not leave her house except under extreme circumstances like going to hospital. But she wanted to do something to make her community better. And she spent countless hours helping people with questions, sorting out problems. She made her community better from her own living room. And I thought, that's just lovely, you know, that you can provide that for people. She got a lot of value out of that, different kinds of value again. And she helped a lot of people. And it's really, I find that really moving when people are doing, you know, giving time that they don't have to give, and having the special quality that volunteers can have precisely because they're not being paid to do the thing.
Yeah.
It changes the relationships.
And
it's a tough world for volunteering, right? Because to volunteer, you need time. And there are a lot of people who love to, but I've got two jobs to work, sorry. And it's like, you can't criticize somebody for that. Right? So it's not an easy world in the world of volunteering at the moment. The last few years, it's struggling, but it's such a precious thing, I think, people giving their time and skills.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm associated with a grassroots football club. I think it's the largest grassroots football club in Reading. There's a, maybe I've left the number wrong, but about 700 players, boys and girls, that, and a men's and women's team.
Must get quite crowded on the pitch.
Yeah, it would get quite crowded on the pitch, yeah. But it's entirely volunteers, the whole thing, because it's quite big, really, but it's entirely volunteers. And so I'm one of the volunteers. And you're right, you know, you're not paid for that. There's no, but you get so much from it when you feel like you're just doing something for the community. It's yeah, quite a powerful thing.
It is. And, you know, you're coaching a kid or whatever, and the kid is thinking, well, he didn't have to do this. It's not, you know, he's doing this because he wants to help me, right?
Yeah, I'm not often sure the children actually think of it.
Well, maybe not. But you can probably tell yourself at some level that they do.
Yeah.
So it is a lovely thing. It can be, you have to, like at a organizational level, you have to think about, okay, are you recruiting new volunteers? Are you enabling volunteers to leave when it's time for them to go, right? So some people who volunteer for things then end up feeling grumpy about it because they're stuck doing something they signed up to do ages ago, and really they'd rather not, but it's not clear who. It's like, unless you bear that kind of thing in mind, then either you don't get enough volunteers or you are imposing on volunteers more than you should.
And it's bound to it.
Yeah, and so that's quite a difficult challenge to get that right at the organisational level, so that you're not exploiting people who are volunteering, right? It should be a joyful thing.
Yeah, fascinating. So I have to come back to it as well, increasing the amount of kindness in the world. I mean, I don't know, even sure what the question is, but what's the state of play for that?
I wouldn't say it's going that well at the moment, right? Well, it kind of is and it isn't. I mean, I have several interests in this kind of area. So one which we haven't talked about before is kidney donation. So I made the mistake of reading a really compelling, well-argued book. I really encourage people not to read books. They're a terrible thing for this kind of thing. And it made a very good argument that there's plenty of people who need kidneys. You've probably got two. Actually, not everybody has two, and that would have been a brilliant reason not to donate if it turned out you only had one. But you don't necessarily need two of them. And it's, I don't know, maybe £250,000 quid donation to the NHS if you donate a kidney. And I just thought about that for a while, and I thought, I cannot annoyingly think of a good reason for not doing that, right? I would take one. It's like blood donation. You know, if you needed it, you'd take it. And if you're prepared to take it, shouldn't you be prepared to give it?
Yeah.
And it turns out you can donate kidneys to strangers. I mean, not, you know, on the street. That's probably not a good idea. but you can. Yeah. And the NHS has done fantastic things in using those to get better matches for lots of other people, so you can kind of trigger a chain of donations where everybody involved gets a better match for their kidney donation than they would do. So a lot of people think of, you know, oh, my sister needs a kidney, I'll donate one to her. But it may be that, well, you can have a match for her, but she could get a better match from somebody else. And there's some great work that they've done in the last few years to try and match people up better and to get more kidneys transplanted successfully through that route. And donations from people who don't really care who it goes to, as long as it's somebody who needs it, they can help with that process. So that, I mean, that's one, yeah, check out and give a kidney, I guess I would say. But it's quite an extreme freegal, right, that. But still, you know, it can change somebody's life quite a lot, and the need is definitely there. Again, wearing my techie geeky hat, I thought, if I suddenly wake up and see a news report that they've now finally cracked how to make artificial kidneys, I'm going to feel a right idiot for not getting around to doing it before then, right? And so I just don't want to hear that on the news. So that's maybe one thing. Yeah, I don't know. What other things? I just think we do not focus on kindness much. There is a lot of other stuff going on in the world, particularly online, where people are not kind enough to each other. Mm. It's like a cliche that people say things to each other that they wouldn't say face to face, partly because they might be worried they'd get a smack in the mouth. But it's not just about whether, it's partly just that when you properly see another human being in front of you, often you wouldn't say some of the things that people say online. So that kind of how to make the online world generate kindness as opposed to being a sort of cesspit that swallows up kindness and turns it into bile. I like that kind of idea. Mm. You were asking how it was going. I mean, there's a lot of quiet kindness that you don't necessarily see. My mother has dementia and I'm caring for her, and I was chatting to her window cleaner, been the same guy for a long time now, and he's just a young lad, and it turned out he had cared for a woman at his church who had quite aggressive dementia, aggressive in the sense of making you aggressive, and he'd been her carer for the last few years of her life. And I don't know, I would never have known that, right? That's just completely under the radar. He must have pumped so much energy and so many hours into that, and it's not something you would see on Twitter. So you can console yourself with the hope that there's a lot of kindness going on under the covers that you don't come across, you don't see.
We see the bad news, we don't see the good news as much, but the majority might be the good news. It intrigues me around the kindness piece, really, because in terms of, say, anger or meanness, it tends to leave you less well once you've done that, and it obviously leaves the other person less well as well. So it seems to be a lose-lose situation usually to be mean. It's not a good effect on you, it's not a good effect on them, whereas to be kind typically leaves you actually with some benefit too, and obviously benefits the other person. So it feels like it's more of a win-win, and you'd think then that would be the natural state.
I mean, I'd like to think that, but you can easily make arguments against it, right? People like being mean. It can be quite, you know, some people like being mean, clearly, because we are. I mean, I'm not saying this as though I'm great and other people are mean, you know. I think there are definitely times when I could be kinder and less mean. There's got to be some enjoyment and some value in it somewhere, otherwise it wouldn't still be around, right?
True.
So I wouldn't quite think like that. I was just trying to think, but can we not just nudge it a little bit more towards a bit more kindness and a bit more care?
Yeah. Well, it's clear, well, we've covered a range of topics, haven't we? We've got a lot of topics, but it's clear for me that sense of wanting there to be more kindness is really a deep feeling for you, quite visceral. I mean, even to the extent of, like you say, like, you know, a kidney donation, because you feel that's
I mean, that's right. Literally visceral, right? That's
that's very visceral.
That is in your guts.
But where does it come from, that sort of deep, innate feeling for you? What's the origin of that for you?
It's really hard to say when you have something that's quite deep. I've always been quite an abstract thinker, I guess. So, you know, if you work in IT or that kind of background, you're often thinking at quite an abstract level.
Yeah.
And there isn't really anything special about me. I mean, everybody's a me, right? So it's just that feeling that, okay, you know, I might want something, but somebody else might want something. Those are equal, right? Those, I might need something, somebody else might need something. What's the difference? From a bird's eye view, we're both people who need things. It's very hard to actually live that, you know, and I don't mean to suggest that I do, actually. I think there's a lot of things wrong with the way I live. But you, if you properly try to think of people as just being a person and having some value because of that, then trying to do something that helps a little bit is a natural thing to do. But that's not really an explanation. That's just me saying that it feels now quite natural. But it, in a weird kind of way, is that that feeling that, well, I can't think of a good argument against that. Yeah. don't have a great answer for that, really.
Probably the last area, and we touched on it earlier, but charities, and it might be a bit of a leading question based on the conversation that we had last time we spoke, but the way that we think about charities and so on, does anything need to change there?
Yeah. So I know what you're alluding to. So to pull back the curtain, I've recommended to Gary that he watch quite an old talk called The Way We Think About Charities Is Dead Wrong. And so I'm going to caricature slightly, right? It's very easy to think of a charity as thinking basically it shouldn't take any money to run, right? Because you can do loads of great stuff with volunteers. Volunteers are brilliant. And if you need somebody to organise the volunteers, well, can you not get a volunteer to organise the volunteers? And so in one sense, we think, well, there isn't really a good argument for why anybody who works for a charity should be paid. But it's like, those people have got rent, though, and you're not going to get some things unless you pay for it. There's an obsession when we look at charities with overhead, where we, you know, everybody, when we give to charity, we want the money to go directly to the people who should benefit, right?
Yeah.
And of course we do. That's what it's for. But the consequences of that mean that you can't, like, let's suppose you've got an old PC and work in a charity office. A lot of charity offices have got old PCs. Spend money on upgrading your PC, that doesn't go directly to help the recipient. It might make you 10% faster in terms of doing your work that does help, but it's kind of, that's not what people donate to charities for, is it, really? They think they don't. You know, if you said, great, you give me some money, now I can buy a new laptop, that's, but what about the kittens? You know, it's not why people donate to charity, but it's a prerequisite. You need that infrastructure to have a functioning organization, right? So it can also lead to not being able to invest, not being able to take risks. So in the business world, I mean, nobody likes to lose money, but you can definitely have a project where it's experimental. You're going to try something out. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, shame. But do enough of those and you'll have something that's successful. In the charity world, if you take a risk and it fails, people can feel personally aggrieved that you have wasted their money on something that failed. And I understand that sense of grievance, but what that means is charities can be paralytically scared of taking risks or of doing something that won't reap any benefit within a single financial year. And that really holds back the charity sector. And it's a problem because it means that you can, in some cases, you can nibble away at problems and you can make things a little bit better, but it's really hard to solve them.
Yeah. I found it really intriguing when you mentioned that. I watched the video and I had never thought about it like that because I instinctively know that in business, it's good to take risk. You want to take calculated risk. That's the whole part of it. You won't actually get anywhere if you don't take some risk. But actually, of course, we probably naturally view charities a little bit different. We don't want them necessarily taking risk with like the money that we've given. We want that to go directly to the recipient in a quite clean line of sight way. But actually not taking risk would then be stifling. And yeah, I had never thought about it, but it makes sense now.
I'm not saying that people are daft to think about that, to worry about charity waste. And if you look, you can always find examples of waste. If we looked at businesses, we would definitely find examples of waste, right? But we don't give them as much of a hard time as we do a charity. And I can understand the motivation for that. I can understand why people feel that. But it does hold some of those charities back, and it makes it very difficult to plan, right? You know, it's like, do you want to do something that will reap benefits in 3 years? Like right now, everybody in the tech world is obsessing about AI, right? And quite right too, because it's remarkable the advances that have been made. And for my mother, I have cobbled together an answer phone that uses AI to help when I cannot get to the phone in time to answer her call, that will respond to her. And it's not responding as well as a person, not responding as well as I would, but it solves the problem that we used to have, where she no longer quite understands what an answer phone is. And so she would hear my voice on the outgoing message. She would think I was talking to her. She would say something, and then I wouldn't reply. And she would conclude that I was angry with her. And then she would ask me if I was angry with her. And it's awful, distressing stuff for her and for me to listen to. And answer phones are just broken for people with dementia in this respect, right? Their businesses are, you know, there are going to be bright people in Silicon Valley working out how to make AI executive assistants for businesses to do the scheduling when you're trying to arrange a meeting and all that, so that all that can happen. But where's that vision in the social care world, the dementia world, right? Because you have to do a three-year project to do this, right? You have to. It's not going to pay back. It's going to be, we're going to do some speculative stuff. We're going to take some risks. It's probably going to come good in a little while. But that kind of risk-taking is really hard to justify within the charity sector, because you don't have the money in the first place, and people give you a hard time if your risks fail. They love it if your risks pay off. And I understand why people do that, right? You know, I get aggrieved as well, but we have to be prepared to take risks in the charity sector as well as the business sector. And if we don't take risks, we just decline steady as we go. We don't solve problems.
You've given a brilliant definition of tech for good.
Well, there does need to be more of it. And like I say, there's a lot of people, not bad people, but the focus is, how can I use this stuff to generate more income for the company that I'm working for? Not necessarily anything wrong with that. But that way of thinking, how can I use this brilliant stuff to generate more social good? That is value too.
Yeah. One final message you'd like to leave for listeners?
Yeah, don't chuck stuff in the bin without seeing if anybody wants it.
Perfect. Yeah. And what's next for you? What do you hope to do next?
Right now, like I say, I'm trying to make Freegle a sustainable organization. That's a challenge. I'm caring for my mother with dementia, and that is hard work. I might try to do something with dementia technology. So, I mean, we haven't talked about it, but I've cobbled together various little Raspberry Pi screens I can scatter around her house to help her. Like, she has a screen in the living room that will tell her what's happening during the day. Right now, it will be telling her I'm going at 2 o'clock to take her out for some cake and coffee. But by the time she gets to the hallway where the telephone is, she won't necessarily, poor thing, remember what was on the screen that was in the living room. So I've put a screen that goes by the telephone that reminds her what's going on. And there are various things like that in the world of dementia, just because I'm exposed to it at the moment, where I think we could be doing a better job to help people stay in their own homes for longer and help lift a little bit of the burden off the people who care for them. It's not a fun process to go through if you have dementia, and it's hard work caring for people.
I can imagine.
So maybe there's something I can do there.
And like you say, people would normally want to be in their home for as long as they possibly can, and there is a large burden on carers as well.
And tech has made that so much better, actually, in terms of enabling people to be in their own home, right? So early on, for example, my mother wouldn't always hang up the phone correctly. Without cameras in her home, I can't tell whether she's all right. If she's just not hung up the phone properly, but she's pottering around in the living room making a cup of coffee, that's fine. I can wait until she next picks up the phone. But I just don't know without cameras to see it. So there are a lot of lovely tech things which are helping people. They're not a substitute for people, but they are helping people stay in their own homes for longer. And that's where they can have the best quality of life, often up to a point.
Mm. Yeah. Lovely to end on. Edward, you are a fabulous man. I knew that the last time we spoke. I've loved having you as a guest on here. I think you are the first person that I've spoken with who's focused on tech for good, and I definitely hope to speak with many more people that are focused on the same space.
Well, I'm just a guy, but still, thank you. It's been fun talking.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. Thanks, yeah. Edward.
All right, cheers.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Moved. If it sparks something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Gary Watts, and I'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.